Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Va a llegar el gol del Arsenal. Ozil marca. Mesut Ozil.
Is Arsecast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, good morning to you, or as somebody on the Discord said, sadly morning.
Sadly morning. It is the morning. That much we know. The quality of the morning is open to some debate.
Hey, look, when we get our other mornings back, the morning will be much better. That's what I'm thinking.
Right.
The other aspects of morning that we're missing, as soon as they come back, everything will be perfect. It'll be a goodly morning again.
That's true. Yeah. We don't have some key breakfast ingredients.
Exactly. We've got some oats, and we've got a bit of gone off milk and some old coffee grounds. Actually, we don't even have that. We've got some like hickory chips or
some
whatever.
Unripened fruit.
Yeah.
And we're trying to cobble something together.
Yeah, but we spent 130 million on these breakfast bits.
We did, yeah. It was quite a lavish shot, and we've not returned with anything particularly nutritious.
Okay, look, we could drag this one out. Tell me this. You were there yesterday. It was Arsenal 0, Chelsea 2, first home game of the season. Before we delve into the nuts and the bolts of all of what went on, what was it like there? What was it like being back? I know there were fans back for the Brighton game at the end of last season, but this feels like proper back, if you know what I mean. Like, take that back.
Definitely.
For good, just so people know.
It was fantastic, actually, and it's sort of a shame that we probably won't spend more time reflecting on that big positive, because it was brilliant to see the stadium full. I was not in the press box. I was in my season ticket. Saw a lot of familiar faces, people I know, and had a hug with Gunnosaurus. I mean, genuinely, it was, fantastic. I didn't social distance from that dinosaur. I was sucked into his warm embrace.
He's wearing a mask.
He's wearing a mask. I believe he's double jabbed. We're not even sure that dinosaurs can carry the virus. So it was, it was great. And that first 10 minutes or whatever it was, 15 minutes of the game was rocking. It was electric. You know, Martin Odegaard was out on the pitch, got a brilliant welcome. People were in the ground really early because there was kind of anxiety over whether or not the new digital season tickets would work.
So
people had to kind of pile into the ground earlier than they normally would, but that led to kind of building up the atmosphere and people, you know, getting on board. It was just great. And I really, really did love being back there among the fans. Obviously, we didn't get the result or the game that we wanted, but that element of it was superb. And if by chance at some point we do win a game this season, it's going to be a really good feeling.
Yeah, look, I have to say, on TV, it came across really well.
Did it? And
It did. You know, it came across like people were behind the team. They wanted the team to do well. I think everyone was realistic about, you know, what was going to happen yesterday or what the chances of Arsenal winning were. And that's, I think, something that we're going to discuss now in a moment. But even when Chelsea went ahead, you know, the crowd responded. I know there were some boos at halftime and boos at the end, but I think those were not really aimed at the performance per se. I think it was more a general statement about where we are. During the 90 minutes, it came across very clearly that the crowd were behind the team. They wanted the team to do well. They were supporting the team. And even afterwards, there was a, you know, there's a lot of questions for Mikel Arteta to answer about, you know, what he's doing and what he's not doing and what the team are doing, etc., etc. And even he, I think, dealt quite well with a question from Jeff Shreves afterwards, who said, you know, you said you wanted the crowd behind you, but, you know, there were boos at halftime and boos at the end. And I think he dealt with that pretty well. I don't know if you've seen it. He was just saying, look, I never got the sense that the crowd weren't behind the team during the game, which is what you want from supporters during the game. At the end of the game, people can, you know, express themselves the way that they want. But, you know, as difficult as it was, and on a day when the team itself didn't give supporters a great deal to be excited about, I think the most energized they got was when Kieran Tierney went running down to chase to chase the ball and didn't get the ball in the end. But, you know, that was kind of the biggest cheer of the day, which says a lot about what the team delivered. You know, I think it's to the fans' credit that they were so supportive, you know, on the day. So it did sound good.
Oh, I'm glad about that. Yeah, and I kind of feel for people who aren't people who get to the ground regularly or very often at all. I wonder how much of a boon or how much of a difference it makes to have those stands full. So I'm glad it translated. And yeah, that really was the thing that, you know, I took away from yesterday, feeling good about everything else. You know, was not ideal, even if it was not entirely unexpected as well. You know.
That's true. That is true. And this is where I'm wrestling with things at the moment because, you know, there's a logical part of my brain. I see where we are. I see what we've got to do. I see, you know, why we are where we are. And I you know, obviously there's a lot of focus on Mikel Arteta, but I think a lot of what of where we are is not just on him. You know, there are a lot of things that have happened over the last number of years that have us where we are right now, and he's responsible for what happens on the pitch. He picks the team, etc., etc. But this sort of sense of realism is painful, and I really genuinely dislike all of it. You know, going into a game against Chelsea, I know they're better than us. They've got better players. They're a more developed team. They've got, like, their bench yesterday was fucking ridiculous. It was ridiculous when you looked at what was going on. Like, if by chance Arsenal had, you know, taken a lead or were hanging on to a lead, look at what they had to try and change the game on the bench. You know, it's absurd, really, to compare. And you could see the gulf was there yesterday. But this idea that we're sort of, as Arsenal fans, as Arsenal Football Club, writing off games before they happen, even if there's good reason for it, I find it very difficult. I don't like it at all.
But I didn't write it. I thought I did that fan thing of kidding myself Arsenal could get something from this, you know, like that's... and of course they could have done, you know, if certain incidents go a different way, anything can happen out on the pitch. I don't think we should be writing it off. I agree. But I don't think people would be as hurt as they are if they had written it off. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do think there was a sense of inevitability about it, though, that nobody really believed we would win or could win. I think there was hope. And when you get into the stadium on a sunny day and you've got 60,000 people there around you, and, you know, certainly when the game kicked off and I was watching it and I could hear the songs and I could hear the crowd get behind the team, you do hope. But I don't really think there was a great deal of belief. And I've seen a lot of discussion about how, well, look, the season really starts when the transfer window ends. You know, we're not going to get anything from Manchester City. There's no way. I mean, we don't get anything from Manchester City. It's been a long time. And again, we're in a similar kind of situation where you know, the gulf between the two teams, even with all our players available, is big. So, you know, this idea that, okay, look, we'll just get beyond the Man City game, and then it becomes a little more manageable when you've got Norwich at home, and then I think it's Burnley, and then there's the North London derby. So you're looking to start your season. I just find it difficult to get my head around that's where we are as a football club. And I again... I get it. I understand it. I see the problems. I know we've got a lot of work to do to get back to where we want to get to, but it hurts. It hurts.
Yeah, I think that's natural, isn't it? I mean, it's like,
yeah,
it's the tension between expectation and reality.
Mm.
You know, as Arsenal fans, particularly Arsenal fans who lived through a very successful period in the club's history, and I'm not just talking about Arsene Wenger there, really. If you look at Arsenal kind of from the late 80s through to, 2005 or whatever it is, Arsenal won a lot of trophies in that period of time. And, you know, along with Manchester United, were probably the dominant force in English football through that period. And it was a long period. We had dips, but they were brief.
Yeah.
And now we are in a more, I think we're in a more pronounced dip.
Rut.
In a very different landscape where we aren't one of those two big clubs that will just sort of manage to be there by crook. You know, we are probably at best the fifth or sixth best team.
I think that's generous.
Yeah, at best, I mean. Mm. And in all reality, according to the league table, kind of the eighth best team. And I think that inevitably that makes fans feel bad because they have been reared or come to experience or expect a degree of success that currently I don't think we're capable of attaining right now. Like, I think even the best outcome of this season is going to make fans feel shit quite a lot of the time.
What do you think that best possible outcome for this season is? Like, if you're saying
probably fifth in the league.
That's the absolute best that we could do.
Well, No.
I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you because I think that's probably right.
Yeah, there's a chance of something better, of course. But I'm saying, like, that I think is sort of realistic but would still be, you know, sort of the high end of probability. Fifth, I think, is probably
do you think that
the
would
best
make
we can hope for.
People feel shit? Because I think that would actually make people feel quite good. Like, if you offered me fifth now, I'd bite your hand off for it because I could see, like, if you're finishing fifth in a league where, you know, we know who the big teams are, but West Ham are looking good and Leicester are a decent team and blah, 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 blah. It would certainly indicate some progress, wouldn't it? That, you know, A, we might be able to score a goal. B, we might win the odd game here and there. And we've probably got more points this season than last season. So that would be, by any tangible metric, progress. So I would definitely take that. I'm not quite as... I think I agree with you that that's the best we could do if everything goes as well as it can over the next number of months. But I'm not convinced we can get that high. But I think
when I say
it
make people feel shit, I think, yes, you can sit back from it and say, oh, that sounds good. But it might involve losing twice to Chelsea.
Mm.
Or it might involve losing a North London derby. Or it might involve getting beat in games you don't expect to get beat. I mean, we could finish fifth and lose a dozen games, and each one of those will make fans feel shit.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? Like, what I mean is there'll be points along the journey which will feel like, ugh, this is not good.
How,
we may be at one of those points.
Yeah, we may be. I mean, how do you rationalize or come to terms with stuff like when you go into the game yesterday? I thought we were going to get beaten before the game because of their strength, because of the players we had missing, because of our general weakness in comparison to this Chelsea side at this moment in time, right? Mm-hmm. I thought we would get beaten. The logical part of my brain tells me that. So I try and come to terms with it and think, okay, well, what can we take from this game that might be encouraging, blah, blah, blah. But even if you steel yourself for a result, if it's expected, you still have to deal with the emotion of losing. The short term, like, you can say, I think we were going to lose this game, but it's still really painful to lose it. You know what I mean? It is. Mm-hmm. It's hard to marry those two things at times.
It is. There's no, and that's, I lose count the amount of times we had this conversation last season about how impossible it is in football to balance long-term with short-term, because the short-term emotion of winning or losing trumps everything.
Mm.
And that is the problem that Arsenal have right now, in my opinion. You know, they have committed to a strategy. If you look at their transfers this summer, for example, and the contracts they've given to younger players, where clearly there is an emphasis on the long term. Mm. And to a certain extent, fans have shown in the past they are prepared to buy into that. However, that was in a period, you know, say post the Emirates Stadium move, where there were only really four decent teams in England.
Mm.
and Arsenal, you know, they could afford to kind of get by as the fourth, and it kept them in the Champions League. It kept them relevant. The situation now, the context now is different. There are at least six teams, probably more like seven or eight, competing for those spots. And so the kind of baseline of Arsenal's possible outcomes for this season is substantially lower. And it's very... There's just a massive tension at play between the idea of kind of patience and the reality of what losing games feels like.
Mm.
And it's what makes managing a football club a very difficult job. And I'm not sure that there is a way to resolve those two. The only way to kind of resolve that tension is to get, you know, I guess for Arsenal, it's to get sixth place. Mm. Do you know what I mean? It's to get the sort of minimum. There's a minimum level that fans will accept while you're kind of going through this process of regeneration. And if you fall beneath that, I don't think any amount of sort of patience or youth development or any of those things is going to save you.
Well, look, let's talk the game. And I thought the first few minutes were okay. You know, pretty bright. We didn't have a lot of players who we know, but I don't know that there's much point in dwelling on the players that we didn't have. We all know that. We all understand that. Ben White was absent with COVID, probably not going to be available for the Man City game.
Mm.
Were you surprised that we didn't go with a back three, even though Ben White was absent?
I wonder if White had been fit, would we definitely have done? I mean, it's what I would have done to match up Chelsea. But, and you know, even without White, like you say, there were other options. You could have brought Callum Chambers in. You could have had Kieran Tierney as a third centre-half. You could have played somebody like Tavares or Maitland-Niles or whoever as a left wing-back. There were ways you could do it. I think on reflection, that would have been better. But I think almost anything would have been better than what... than the defensive mistakes that we made. I mean, they were kind of identical, Chelsea's goals, in that they came via that overlap on the right-hand side. And I've watched it, and I still can't quite... I mean, we're so far from defending it that it's almost impossible to work out who was supposed to be there because there's nobody near.
Yeah.
But I mean, we'll come on to that with the goals, I guess. But the defensive shape didn't work at all.
No, it didn't. And I think this is one of the issues that I have with yesterday, even rationalizing Chelsea's strength and our, you know, relative weakness for all the reasons, et cetera, et cetera. The fact that we didn't react to that threat quickly enough is, you know, we can talk about quality all we want, but managers can deal with gulfs in quality by setting up their teams through organization, defensive shape. How many times have we seen a really, really good Arsenal side struggle to break down? Now, it hasn't happened in the very recent past, but, you know, it used to be a case that you'd have an Arsenal side chock full of, like, great attacking talent struggling to break down a Blackburn or a Birmingham or somebody like that because they were organized defensively, particularly when Arsenal got into the final third, right? Mm. So it's not a case, I mean, they often did sit with just men behind the ball. And I realize that it's, you know, it's maybe a difficult way to play when you're at home the first game of the season and all that. But the fact that we didn't react, or Arteta didn't react to the threat of Reece James down the right-hand side, where he had the freedom of the Emirates Stadium, basically, to do what he wanted in that opening 45 minutes anyway, was, I think that's one of the big criticisms I have of yesterday. I would have played with a back three. I think the decision to play Pablo Mari one-on-one, basically, with Lukaku was ridiculous. But that Reece James thing, and Arteta didn't react anywhere near quickly enough to sort that out, and from there, both Chelsea goals arrived.
Yeah, I think we need to look at the players as well in that one. I mean, nobody wants to criticise Bukayo Saka, but he's nowhere on those. And for me, if Tierney is under instruction to tuck in, which it seems is the case, because on both goals he folds into a very central position, you know, the guy who's playing in front of him has got to come back. And he's miles away, absolutely miles away. And listen, I might be wrong. It might be that Granit Xhaka's supposed to fold out there, but that would be a bit odd, to be honest. I just think, you know, I accept that there was a risk there, but, and maybe Arteta should have changed it, but also players have got to track their men.
Yeah.
Arsenal didn't do that.
I'm looking here at where Saka is, and I think he's on Jorginho for the second goal. He's on Jorginho. And he's in the middle of the thing. Chelsea work it. But yeah, there's way too much.
I mean, that can't be right. Like,
no.
Well, yeah, that can't be right, because Arsenal have got two central midfield players. You know, somebody, if Tierney is going to go inside as that centre-half, someone needs to go with him. And listen, Saka can get away with anything. He's untouchable, and I completely understand why. I feel the same. But, you know, that was really poor, I think. And, you know, he's not a defender and blah, 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 and that aspect of the game, he'll improve. But, yeah, for that to happen twice, maybe Arteta should have done something. You know, he's got options. He could... it could be as simple as having a word with Saka, you know, and saying, look what's happening behind you, or switching things around to put another player on the left-hand side who might give a bit more defensively. It's not like Saka, really, and that's why I'm sort of scratching my head about it. But it felt like Tierney... what it ended up looking like in both instances was like Tierney had kind of gone rogue by filling in as a centre-half.
Yeah.
But I just don't believe... I just can't imagine that he would. But but maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe it was, you know, a case of firefighting. I don't quite know, but
he wasn't happy, Tierney. I mean, he was throwing his arms around a lot in that first half. So something wasn't working out. And he was having a difficult game, a very difficult game himself. But yeah, I would have gone three at the back. I wonder why he didn't. I feel like, again, to sort of return to that short-term versus long-term thing, you know, there was such criticism last season of what's the identity, why are we still persisting with three at the back? It almost feels like he's now, like, tried to move on from that and is reticent to go back. But yesterday was definitely a day to do it.
Well, I mean, look, what's the identity is still a valid question, I think, because we're not really sure of what it is anymore. So that's another question. The first goal, look, Pablo Mari statistically had quite an interesting game. When you look at the stats, I think he had four tackles, which was as much as anybody else in the team, four block shots, two interceptions, three clearances. Statistically, you know, it looks like he had a good game. Your eyes, though...
Not from where I was sat.
No, not from where anyone looking at it would go, oh my God, this guy got absolutely ruined by Lukaku. Yeah. Ruined. And this is why I think, you know, I'm not excusing his performance in any way, because it was really poor. And I think as time goes on, we're seeing that this is a guy who should be at very best back up. And I think he's quite lucky to be that. You know, at a club like Arsenal, there were always doubts for me over his career trajectory and the pathway that he took to Arsenal, simply because it's so unconventional. I don't really understand how a player of his age could make that move. But, you know, maybe there are things we could discuss another day on that. But he was destroyed by Lukaku on that first goal in particular. It was just so easy. You know, he received the ball with his back to goal, held him off. And from there, like, I know he's strong and I know he's fast and I know he's powerful and I know he's like a striker at peak age, at the top of his powers and all the rest. But I think Pablo Marie was just weak and slow, didn't read the situation at all. You know, he was slow to react when Lukaku ran towards goal. He wasn't the right side of him. He decided he would try and get a free kick by falling over. I don't think Lukaku had to do an awful lot to you know, flatten him. He didn't really flatten him. Marie just fell over looking for a free kick. So it really was terrible defending.
Yes, it was a ragdolling of Pablo Marie. Mm. I do think better defenders than Pablo Marie will struggle against Lukaku. He just looks to be at the absolute peak of his powers and he looks quite a frightening prospect for the rest of the Premier League. But yeah, he was, well, from where I was sat and from what I could see, he was way off it. And I think maybe he is good enough to be, you know, our fourth centre-half. The problem is, at the present time, we have to keep playing him. And, you know, I know people talk about Ben White being out. I have to be really honest and say I'm not sure Ben White would have lived with Lukaku either, based on what I saw at Brentford.
No. I mean, that's fair. But maybe, you know, again, coming back to the back three thing, Ben White in the back three might have been...
Yeah. I think Gabriel is the guy who physically, you know, could live with Lukaku. He's the only centre-half I think we've got who has the athleticism required to kind of go shoulder to shoulder with him. And we've seen him have good games against, you know, the kinds of centre forwards who want to pin their man before. But yeah, Lukaku played from the first minute like a guy who knew he had the better of his marker. And, you know, you could see the confidence flowing through him every time he held the ball up or turned Marie or, you know, just nudged ahead of him in the box. And it just grew and grew and grew. And it was a bad day for Pablo Marie. Really, really bad.
Was,
and I think
it was Drogba, Senderos, but worse.
Yes, it was. And I mean, Senderos has the excuse that he was a very young player at that time, you know. But it was eerily reminiscent of the way Drogba tortured Arsenal. Yeah, I mean, I saw a tweet from Tim Steelman saying he thinks that Chelsea buying Lukaku might grant them the league. And I replied saying it does have that slight feel of when Van Persie went to Man U. They've plugged in a kind of 30-goal striker.
Yeah.
You know, it just felt like he'd been playing there forever yesterday. But for us, it was kryptonite, essentially. Mm. And I worry a little bit about what it might do to Pablo Marie's confidence. You know, I think it was a heavy beating he took from Lukaku.
Well, it's the kind of performance that should, you know, under normal circumstances, see you out of the team for a while, you know?
Yeah.
The issue is, of course, we don't know quite how soon Gabriel is going to be back. And man, we really need him to be good. We really need Gabriel to be good.
He trained on Saturday, I believe, but he's not played football for quite a while now.
Yeah.
So I think it'll be touch and go for next weekend. I don't think he'll be ready for Wednesday night.
Maybe the only thing you would say about Pablo Marie is that he's of a certain age that he might be able to compartmentalize that performance if he is picked for next weekend.
And like I say, I think it will happen to better players. It just so happened that he was first and it was particularly pronounced, the sort of gap between the two players.
Let's think about some other stuff from this game. Should we have had a penalty?
Do you know what? I went to get a drink. I have seen it since, and yes. But I, about 40 minutes, it was 2-0 at that point. Just thought, I've got to get in the queue for a drink here, actually.
Need some whiskey.
Yeah, exactly. So I went for my whiskey at the Emirates bar. So I didn't see this in real time. But yes, it did It looked to me to be a foul. Did you think the same?
Yeah, I thought so. It's a classic of the anywhere else on the pitch, that's a free kick sort of situation. Yeah. You know what I mean? To me, it's a penalty. And look, I get it would have been the slimmest of lifelines. But at 2-1, you know, you just never know. You never know.
Oh, yeah.
And
I think
we're unfortunate.
That was definitely
one
of the ways back into the game.
Yeah.
And we were a bit unfortunate. And, you know, we're told there's this sort of higher bar for VAR intervention this season. I think generally that is a good thing. And I probably support that move. But we have been a bit unfortunate in both the Brentford game and this game. You know, if you think of the one where Balogun got taken out in the box, I think last season, both of those probably would be penalties, right or wrong.
Yeah, I think that was unfortunate, but you know, it's not our biggest issue. What else? I think one of the things that concerns me most, James, is coming back to this idea of identity and what we are and what we want to do and how we want to play. And I'm more and more in the dark about that as time goes on, because I don't quite know what it is that we are trying to do. And maybe a game against Chelsea isn't the right way to judge that. And maybe a game against Brentford, you know, with all that went on before it, with the COVID cases, etc., is not the right way to judge that. But we were sort of chatting a little bit last night on WhatsApp. And I'm the idea that we will improve, like Arteta was asked afterwards, you know, will this team be better when we get our players back 100%? It'll be a completely different team, he said. And I can see some logic in that. If you get Thomas Partey back in the team, if you get Gabriel back in the team, if you get Martin Odegaard in the team, if you get, I can't remember.
Yeah, exactly.
You get Aubameyang, who actually looked quite sharp when he came on, all things considered. You know, if you start getting those players back into the team, I can understand how there will be improvement, because better players make you better, right? They can, they improve you. But I'm wondering, are we just looking at these players coming in and just being better on their own? Or should we not be looking at this as players who are coming in? Like, I don't quite know how to explain this or express it properly. But like, if you're saying, this is Arsenal, this is what we are, this is what we're trying to do, and right now we're doing it with these players, and they're not as good as some of the other players that we have. But we're going to do this thing, we're going to play this way, and if we plug in a center forward who's good, and if we plug in a central midfielder who's good, and if we plug in an attacking midfielder who's good, you can see how in each of those positions, exponentially, we are going to be better. Do you know what I mean? But I don't see the framework that they plug into. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. I do think that particularly the Chelsea game is a tricky one to see that in. They're not likely to let us. I mean, they are a lot better than us. And I hate saying it, but they are a lot better than us. Even with our, like, I'm not sure we win that game with all those players available. You know, I really don't think that's still not the likeliest outcome, is it? Which tells you something. I think, yeah, I think those players do make a difference. I'm not expecting, as I've just said, I'm not expecting those players to make us as good as Chelsea. I'm expecting those players to make us about as good as we were for sort of the second half of last season, which is like, okay,
it's not great.
Not amazing.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was good enough to, you know, we all know the results it produced, blah, blah, blah. We all know the second half of the season, if that was elite, where would we stand? Blah, blah, blah. We all understand that. But I don't think it's going to make us great, but I do think it will make us better. As for the plan, I mean, what I said to you yesterday on WhatsApp, which I sort of stand by, is that like some players are the plan. Like Thomas Partey transforms what we can do in midfield, I think. Sammy Lokonga was yesterday, and I thought he was really encouraging. I think he does. And I actually think that, like, in this game, until Aubameyang came on, with respect to Martinelli, I just thought we looked like a team without a centre-forward. I mean, it looked like we weren't playing one at times. And that's not to be personally critical of him, but we had no presence or structure or threat in the final third. And I think that is about individual quality, personally.
Mm.
But the points you make are very valid in that, you know, it's that old exercise. If you had to give someone, you know, two sentences to describe what Mikel Arteta's Arsenal do or try to do, very difficult to say.
It is, you isn't know. It?
Yeah. But I think that they're a team who get sort of caught between two stools quite often. They end up kind of not quite being one thing or the other. And that sort of amorphous identity is a problem for a manager.
Mm. Yeah. I'm
struggling a little bit with this. I mean, I hope that when these guys come back, when Aubameyang is fit, when Partey is fit, when Odegaard is fit, when we can, you know, get a fully fit Bukayo Saka back in the team, when mm-hmm. hopefully we have a central defence worth talking about, when we sort out whatever the fuck we're going to do with right back. I mean, that is a crazy situation, isn't it? Right back.
Yeah, I mean, another name that we've not mentioned is Hector, obviously, who wasn't in the squad yesterday, I believe was unavailable. I think he probably would have played if he was, to be honest. And again, that's no excuse, but when you see Cedric in that starting lineup, it doesn't fill you with confidence because you know this is a guy Arteta basically hasn't wanted to use for about 6 months. And it does speak to a slightly absurd situation at right back where we have four guys, but none of them are the guy. I do think that is sort of increasingly, and maybe it's just because we've got other business done, but if there is any life left in this window, I think it has to be focused on that area of the pitch because it's a big, big problem for us.
I mean, the selection of Cedric really speaks to the problem we have there because in our final warm-up game of preseason, Cedric was essentially our fourth choice to play at right back behind Ainsley Maitland-Niles.
Mm.
But now he's starting against Chelsea? That's not right. You know, I'm not going to go to town on the player. I think he's, you know, I think he's quite average. I think the deal is just appalling. One of the worst bits of transfer business we've done to give a guy like that a four-year contract at his age. But the fact that he is starting a game against Chelsea really tells you that there is a problem in that position or a problem with the manager's decision-making when it comes to that position. I don't quite know. And it's not to pin everything on him, of course. The problem was collective, you know, really. But I don't know how we can go through a season with that kind of uncertainty at right back as to who is going to be there.
Like I mean, ultimately, Callum Chambers had a bad game against Brentford.
Got dropped.
But got dropped. But I would sort of say, I suppose if Arteta thinks Callum Chambers is his guy, then he should be picking him again.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the fact that he ditched Chambers just speaks to a huge amount of uncertainty over that part of the pitch. And as for Cedric, I mean, listen, he's not a terrible player. He's tidy enough. Mm. I think physically he's a way off. You know, if you compare him to Reece James physically, there's a big gap there. And as he gets older, that gap's going to get wider. And, you know, he was up against Alonso, was it? A left wing back for Chelsea, who's about a foot taller and about 4 yards quicker. And I think that was the problem. I think it's something that needs to be addressed. Mm. I'm not saying that means it will be addressed. I think, you know, more movement is going to be probably dependent on getting people out. But I really hope it is because we need something. We need a right back for sure.
Yeah, we do. I did enjoy Rob Holding leaving a bit on Alonso. So fair play to Rob Holding for that. That was one of the most enjoyable moments of the day. Chelsea fans booing Bukayo Saka, go fuck yourselves.
Yeah, I didn't hear that. I was at the opposite end of the ground, but was it all
here? Yeah, you could hear it very clearly on the TV. So that, and I was reliably informed that one of our former goalkeepers may now be at Chelsea, came from Chelsea, was in the director's box, jumping up and down and celebrating Chelsea's goals, which is a bit fucking classless, isn't it, from Petr Cech?
Yeah, I would think he'd be better than that,
yeah,
to be honest.
There's a bit of, like, decorum required in that sense, particularly when you've played for the club.
Well, that's why, I'm surprised. I mean, he generally has carried himself quite well. So, that's a little bit disappointing.
Mm.
But not as disappointing as, you know, the result generally. And just that feeling of... It's just that feeling of inferiority, you know. It's a horrible reality to be confronted with how far away we are. And I think, you know, I'm in that camp of people that really do think the absentees are a problem and they are making a sizable difference. But I am also in the camp of people who would say that even with them, I think this Chelsea side is good enough to beat us relatively comfortably. Mm. And, you know, they are... Do you know what? There was a guy next to me who very loudly was chanting, shit club, no history. And I admired him for it. And I was like, I see where you're coming from there. But I also, it made me a bit sad because I was like, who cares? Like, those Chelsea fans don't care. They're winning.
Mm.
And in football, history is important, but it's only worth so much. You know, I sort of had this slight feeling of like, we sound like Liverpool fans in the 90s, you know, banging on about things that happened 20 years ago. I think culture and tradition are significant, but winning on the day is worth so much more. That's the nature of sport, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's a chant for a team that aren't winning right now.
Mm. Well, then this just brings us full circle to this sort of...
Yeah, how do you deal with that?
How do you deal with the...
There was another fascinating interaction behind the goal where there was a row... A kind of existential debate between two fans about whether or not Granit Xhaka was a cunt. So it was kind of amazing.
Did they lay out their definition of what a cunt is?
So Xhaka made a mistake. I think it was a misplaced pass or he got caught on the ball. Something, you know, something like that. And one guy jumped up and was like, Xhaka, you cunt. And then a guy behind him was like, we don't need that sort of thing, you know. Let's get behind the team. And he's like, right, so what, you're going to support a loser then, are you?
Oh.
And he was like, no, I'm just saying, you know, we're supporting the team now. He's like, look. And then the guy turned around and he sort of started asking people around him, right, is Granit Xhaka a cunt? And it became this whole thing of like people chipping in and being like, well, you know. Maybe he is, maybe he's our cunt, you know. There was all this stuff. I mean, in a way, it was great. And I was like, it's fantastic.
Welcome back to the ground, yeah.
But it was also a kind of interesting dialectic about, you know, how do we feel about this team and where we are? And how do we be positive in a time that feels fundamentally short of our own expectations?
Mm.
And I think, you know, it's a process we're all navigating internally. And, you know, I couldn't tell you, I knew what this guy meant. You know, I know what he means. He's like, this isn't good enough. I want better. But the guy behind him is saying, yeah, but this is where we are. Let's work with the circumstances we're in. And it's, you know, you see that played out across social media, everywhere. It's a kind of existential debate of the Arsenal fan right now.
Yeah, I mean, brilliantly captured, I have to say. Well, look, whether or not Granit Xhaka is a cunt or isn't a cunt, the season lies ahead.
We'll find out in part two when we come to your questions.
But like the season that lies ahead, I think, has bigger questions hanging over it than that one in particular, even though, like you, I can recognize, you know, what it says about the wider issues that we have. I don't know that we can answer that one today, but we will answer some of your questions in part two. Is there anything else? Actually, do you know, I just want to say before we go into part two that you touched on it very briefly. I thought Albert Sambi-Lokonga was probably the most encouraging part of yesterday from an Arsenal perspective. I think he's got plenty to come to terms with when it comes to the Premier League. Like, just how quick the game moves. There were a couple of moments where you could see him just sort of look around and go, holy shit, you know, the ball's gone like from there to there and I've got to turn around and get back and what have you. But I just thought the way that he tried to play in those circumstances against that opposition, I thought was really positive. So if we're going to finish part one on a positive note, I think that's it.
Yeah, he was fantastic. And as listeners will know, my brother's a Chelsea fan and he's the first player he mentioned to me after the game. He thought he was the big bright spot in Arsenal. So it's not just our red-tinted spectacles that are seeing it. I thought he was really good, actually. Mm. Really good. I mean, to play against a team of that quality at that age with that little Premier League experience, I think he already looks like someone who could exceed expectations. You know, he's coming from the Belgian league. I think we thought, well, he might get the odd game here and there. It'll be a sort of, you know, a rotation option. I think he'll get plenty of minutes the way he's looking. And that is encouragement. I mean, I even thought Nuno Tavares, when he came on, looked pretty good at left back. He doesn't mess about anyway. He's certainly very, very physical. So yeah, there are young players to be encouraged by. But as we've said all through this show, that doesn't assuage the pain of defeat.
No.
And the pain of where we currently sit. And, you know, we're just trying to kind of muddle through how you balance the optimism of youth with the reality of our circumstance.
Okay, well, look, let's take a break here. We do have plenty of questions, as you might imagine, so we'll come back with those and more in part two right after this. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnerblog and at Arsblog, and also on the Arsblog. Did I do your Twitter there? I forgot what I just said. Gunnerblog and Arsblog.
I think you said it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, at Gunnerblog, at Arsblog, you know. You know, they know the drill
by
now.
They know the drill. Also on the Discord server, which you get access to if you are an Arsblog member on Patreon. So let me ask you this one first, if I might. Comes from...
Can I just do a quick one first? Because Gold's at Gold73 just said, before the second part of the podcast, when you say we'll be back right after this, how long is this usually?
Usually it's, 2 minutes?
Yeah, 90 seconds.
Yeah, thereabouts. Quick, you know, check, maybe a bathroom break. This time it was a bit longer because we were having a very top secret chat about all kinds of scurrilous things. But normally it's, just about 2 minutes. Just catch our breath, reconfigure our brains. Okay.
Go on, ask your question.
I will. It comes from Alistair Wood at AliBoy82. And he said, in 2011, when low on quality available players, Arsenal lost 2-0 at home to a Big Six club and then lost heavily in Manchester, resulting in a deadline day trolley dash. If we lose heavily on Saturday, will history repeat itself next week?
Well, have we not already done the trolley dash? Is sort of my question there. I mean, as I recall, the business we'd done in that transfer window, we'd signed Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain prior to the 8-2.
And Jenko. Did we not
Carl
bring in Jenkinson?
That's right, because he made his debut in that game. Cheers for that, Arsene. I think that may have been it. I'm just having a look now. Oxlade-Chamberlain. maybe we had signed Jovinho as well.
I think so, yeah. Did he play at Old Trafford?
I don't know if he did. Don't remember much about it, so I don't think he made much impact if he did. But then, of course, we went on a trolley dash after that. I suppose what's interesting is the nature of the players we brought in was experienced, really. I mean, particularly in the case of Mertesacker and Arteta. And we have spent a lot of money already in this window, but quite deliberately not on experience. Would that change if we lost heavily next weekend? I personally don't think so. I think that Arsenal's have had a strategy for this summer's business and they've kind of stuck to it. I think there might be a bit more urgency in terms of adding, say, the right back that they need, but I don't expect them to kind of fold back on things and go and get in a couple of senior pros to kind of steady the ship. What do you think?
I don't think there'll be a trolley dash because we have signed, what, five players?
Yeah.
I do think that if we lose and lose heavily to Manchester City, I'm not sure how much pressure there's going to be on transfers as much as the manager. But
very true, yeah.
I do think that we'd be foolish not to try and sort out the right back situation if we can. I think there's a good case that, you know, you could bring in a central midfield player as well. But it feels a bit aspirational. I guess a lot will depend on what happens this week in terms of who's going out, if anybody is going out. I saw a story from David Ornstein today about Eddie Nketiah, Crystal Palace
in there for 10 million.
10 million. Arsenal want 20 million. They must have been listening to this podcast. Because, you know, that kind of crazy valuation you put in their minds, James, is affecting their negotiation skills. So I think, it will depend on who goes out and how many we can shift on. But I don't see... I mean, it would be quite typical of Arsenal to, like, lose to Manchester City and then sign somebody, make a big signing or something to take the focus off it, but...
Yeah, it's not impossible. I mean, maybe it will be a pricier option at right back. I do think, you know, that is clearly a position that needs solving in the long term. And if it requires the club to slightly push the boat out, maybe they'll be inclined to do that after another defeat. But yeah, I don't foresee the trolley dash of a decade ago. I don't see that history quite repeating.
No. Of course, Arteta was in that trolley.
He was. As was Per Mertesacker, both in the club. So, yeah. Haider, who's at Haider_Yavid_14, I hope that pronunciation's okay, Haider, says, is there any difference between Unai Emery's over or sole reliance on Kolasinac and Arteta's on Tierney?
That is a good question. I mean, the lack of variety in our attacking play is a big, big problem. Big problem. And I suppose you would say that Odegaard coming in is going to help in that regard, and getting a striker back might help in that regard. But to me, this is the biggest question. This is the biggest question about Mikel Arteta, is how is this team going to improve from an attacking perspective? How are we going to create more chances? And unless we do something different than give the ball to Kieran Tierney, who may or may not be available for the next little while because he's got another injury, it seems. Mm-hmm. It's like we said last week, it's too easy to work out. It's too easy to work out. If you stop that, then what have we got? Not much comes down the right-hand side. I think that's a problem area for us. But no, I don't suppose there is, really, other than the quality of the left back, in that Tierney, I think, is far superior to Kolasinac.
Tierney's a better player.
But as a tactic, getting the overlap and getting the cutback, it's pretty similar, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. I'm hopeful that Martin Odegaard will add more variety to the attack with his guile and his creativity. Emile Smith Rowe is a really interesting player. Like, I think he's fantastic, but I'm not sure he is a defence splitting passer.
No, he's not. All. He's not. He's a guy who will who'll burst with the ball. He's in some ways he reminds me a little bit of Thomas Rosicki in terms of how he plays. And I think
that's a good comparison.
You know the way Rosicki used to, like, he can carry the ball, same as Rosicki. Rosicki's the way he used to play, the way he used to get close to people and just sort of play those combinations to get people in behind and to create space in behind. I think that's much more what Smith Rowe is. He's not the classic number 10. I think Odegaard is much more similar in that sense. Like, he's a passer. He's the guy who's going to find that pass and pick that pass and you know, create things for people in that way. Whereas Smith Rowe, I think, needs to be close to players. Like, his best moments yesterday came when he combined and there was a couple where he drove into the box. But, you know, they're little short 5, 7, 10 yard combination passes. And I think that could be perhaps an interesting thing from the left-hand side.
Yeah, I think that is where his immediate future lies. You know, I think Odegaard is going to come into that number 10 spot and Smith Rowe will be out there on the left with Tierney. And actually, that was a pretty promising combination for much of last season. So I think we'll see more of that. But yes, it has felt one-dimensional. The sort of get it to Tierney and hope that his cutback finds somebody. I think the only real distinction, as you said, is that Tierney's a better player. But another injury yesterday, I mean, a huge amount is asked of him, isn't it, in the course of these games. And you can sometimes see that taking a toll on his body.
Yeah, I just wonder, you know, between that and maybe just... Maybe he is a little brittle as well.
Yeah.
You know, the injury record is beginning to get a little bit worrying, to be honest.
It concerns me how important both Kieran Tierney and Thomas Partey are and how much we seem to struggle to get them on the pitch. You know, that worries me.
Here's a question from Daniel Williamson, who's at _DAW2503 on Twitter. And he says, has Mikel Arteta moved away from playing out from the back, or is this a temporary switch because of absent players? If it's still the plan, is it worrying that after a summer of preseason preparations, he's not confident enough to do it? And we had a similar question on the Discord from Arteta's Victory Crumpets, who says, I consider myself a patient and understanding Arsenal fan and still willing to be patient this season, but why on earth have we stopped pressing and stopped building from the back? We seem to have abandoned any style of play so far this season.
Yeah, it's interesting as well in the light of signing a goalkeeper who last season went long more than any other goalkeeper in the league. I mean, you know, we're told they think he can play a short game as well, but it does make you wonder, is there a deliberate intention to mix it up a bit? I think so. I think that's partly a choice. But
you mean to play long more often?
Yeah.
But who are we playing long to? Nicolas Pepe, you know, we're just bashing the ball towards Pepe, which is... fairly industrial tactic.
Yeah, I agree. And I think especially in the absence of kind of Aubameyang and Lacazette, you know, who are you aiming for up there? Even with them, I don't
think. Yeah, I mean, that's not their game either, is it?
But, you know, it's something, it's a tired comparison really, but something Manchester City do very effectively. They mix it up. They do go short, but they do go long too when they want to. And it helps them stretch the play a little bit. But it is the pressing.
We don't.
I'm not sure we pressed consistently last season.
No, but even. We don't really press at all anymore.
Right.
Do you not think? I mean, when you think about what we do when the opposition has the ball in their own defensive third.
Certainly not against Chelsea. We didn't. No.
No.
I agree with that.
But we don't try and... Yeah, I mean, I think there's clearly some sort of instruction to not play out from the back yesterday. I was curious to see what would happen with Leno's first kick. And his first kick was long. Mm. And that tells you that we weren't prepared to play out from the back against Chelsea. And this sort of comes back to what we were talking about in that first part of the show, where, like, if you have a style and the players that you have playing that style aren't that good at it, but you keep playing with that style, when you bring in better players, do you then improve that style? Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
Whereas I think we've kind of abandoned what Arteta set out to do very early on. Whether that's him compromising on his principles, whether it's him being pragmatic, whether it's an air of maybe he's not confident in the players that he has to play that way. And then you have that other question about, well, why don't we play more to the strengths of the players that we do have? You know, but I don't... Like, if we
it's
couldn't...
It's tricky, though, isn't it? Because if he had played out from the back and they'd made a mistake, he'd be hammered for that as well, you know?
But is that not something that people can... Well, okay, we didn't do it well in that instance, but this is what we try and do. This is how we try and play.
Some people would have that, would be fair with that, but I doubt many would. I think most people would say, why is he insisting on them playing out the back when they're not good enough? He should have cut his cloth accordingly. He should be more pragmatic. When you lose a game, it's your fault. You got it wrong. And that's football. Mm. But I think it'll be really interesting to see when Ben White is there and maybe when Gabriel is there, how do we play out? Do we play short? Do we play longer? If we're playing longer, as you say, who on earth are we aiming at?
Yeah.
You know, Tammy Abraham had a pretty decent debut for Roma last night. He would have been a striker who you could chuck stuff up to. I'm not sure we've got but one right now.
Mm.
So, you know, and we saw how effective Lukaku was at that, by the way, in terms of being someone you can aim the ball into their feet, into their chest, the ability to pin a centre-half, to bring others into play. You know, we didn't have that at all.
Mm.
I think Arsenal's attack, this is just sort of a personal hunch of mine, needs one of Martin Odegaard or Alexandre Lacazette, because I think they're the players who can provide a kind of hub at the centre of the wheel. And if you've got Odegaard, you don't have to have Lacazette, because you can have Aubameyang and I think it still works. I think without either of those two, we got a lot of spokes and no hub. That's how it seems to me anyway. I felt like Arsenal just looked like they didn't have a reference point in the final third yesterday. It was a lot of, you know, a lot of peripheral stuff. And I didn't say this in part one, but, you know, Martinelli, Saka, Smith Rowe, they're really young players. And I understand that, you know, sometimes they're going to be inconsistent or struggle. I was actually quite disappointed in Nicola Pepe. As the senior man of that four, I did actually hope for a bit more from him, personally.
Mm. I mean, we had a question here from Jess Guna, who's at Jess of ARQ, who says, have we grossly overestimated the potential of Martinelli? When starting through the middle, he's been largely anonymous. Love the player. Say it isn't so.
We had a question like this last week, and I nearly asked it. It was something like, what's your controversial Arsenal opinion? Is there my slightly controversial opinion, and I promise it's not informed by the Chelsea game, is that I do think that the expectations around Martinelli are a little high. From what I hear, from what people say, I think a lot of people see him as someone who's going to start a lot of Premier League games and have a big impact. And I personally am not sure he's quite in that place yet. Say, for example, someone like Bukayo Saka, I think is quite far ahead of Martinelli in how I see them. And that is quite, I think that's quite controversial, because I think a lot of people kind of see them neck and neck. I don't think we've overrated him. I think he's got loads of talent. And I think he's got, as Arteta puts it, a kind of special charisma on the pitch. He's got this huge energy. He's got a nose for goal. I'm talking myself into it just with this list. But maybe it comes from just a requirement of balance and feeling like, you know, we can't have, I don't think, as much as I love the idea of all those kids out there, you know, Martinelli, Balogun, Smith Rowe, Saka, I actually don't think that's viable. I think we need to complement that with more assured, more senior performers who have greater presence and probably greater productivity. What do you think about Martinelli?
I felt sorry for him yesterday.
It was a thankless task.
Yeah, to be a lone striker in a team like this, which doesn't get the ball to its striker, doesn't create chances in the middle, doesn't deliver into dangerous areas, and you're asking him to play against Rudiger and Christensen and Azpilicueta, you know, come on, that's a tough gig for a, what is he, 20 years of age? Like, he didn't have a good game. I'm not saying he had a good game or anything like that, but I just felt for him. And I do think that sometimes individual assessment of players is difficult when the system, the collective, is not great either.
True.
You know, I agree there's a lot of talent there. There's a lot of potential there. I'm not quite sure where exactly he's going to end up. And I think one of the things that we have to consider or have to realize is that, you know, there's a fairly steep learning curve for players, for young players when they come in. You know, someone like Saka, someone like Smith Rowe, they're going to naturally be involved a lot more because they're playing deeper, because they're playing in areas that we get the ball in, even if we're not a great team at this moment in time, we do get the ball into those areas. Therefore, they can be involved. Whereas in this particular setup, what is Martinelli's role other than to finish the chances that we don't make? You know?
Yes, that's fair. And, you know, it's not like he was, you know, missing chances yesterday. Nothing really came his way. Do you think he is a centre forward, or do you think he is a wide player? Do you have an instinct on that?
My instinct is a bit more centre forward, but not like a Lukaku centre forward, if you know what I mean. I think he's somebody who can maybe play a bit more on the shoulders of the defenders, but, you know, sample size is really small with him as well. I think he's somebody you want running towards goal, onto the ball or with the ball. I'm not sure he's necessarily a guy you want out on the wing trying to create or deliver or be that kind of a what you might consider a classic winger with that kind of output, you know?
Yeah, I think he'll end up a centre forward.
I think probably.
I think he might be more comfortable in the wide areas for now, but I do think that's his eventual trajectory. But it was a very difficult day from yesterday, and I thought it was the right decision to pick him there. I mean, Aubameyang can't have been considered that fit because he would have been on at half time, to be honest, if he was. The fact that they waited at all,
yeah,
I think shows that they didn't think he was ready. But he did look, as you said, quite sharp when he came on, and he thought he did improve us. So that's good news in terms of, you know, getting him back and part of the team. Lacazette was at the game yesterday, so presumably his isolation is over. I had a question, actually, about COVID and stuff. Malik Bergman on the Discord said, "Morning, gents. Now that we appear to be in a post-bubble Premier League, I'm increasingly of the opinion that the key variable that will determine a club's fortunes this season will be the extent to which they can control COVID outbreaks in their squads. How sympathetic are you to Arsenal's current plight, especially considering they did appear to attempt to get the Brentford game cancelled? It seems like the Premier League is emphasising personal responsibility on this, and it's up to the clubs to ensure their players are vaccinated and behave responsibly outside of work." And then he says, "If Arsenal players are getting COVID due to risky behaviour and are not recovering quickly because they refuse to be vaccinated, then personally I think Arsenal have only themselves to blame."
Well, look, the thing that I would say is that you cannot mandate, really, players to be vaccinated. You can encourage it, and I think Arteta said that in his press conference at the weekend, or, you know, before the game, that they're trying to educate some of the players, I think is what he said, you know, and get them vaccinated. And I mean, the reality is that there are no restrictions anymore.
No, in England, I'm living here, I'll be honest, it's basically a free-for-all. It's not happening.
And even if players do take personal responsibility, you are, because of because of how easily this virus spreads and how this particular variant spreads, you know, you could go to the supermarket and get it. Your kids can go to school and bring it home, you know, so...
It should be no great surprise, should it, that a club with one COVID case... is going to get more.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Can they tell players not to, you know, live life? If everybody else is allowed to live life, whether it's risky or not risky or whatever, I don't know that they can necessarily tell them to do that. So I think it is going to be a reality for clubs this season. And this is why I'm curious as to what the threshold is for, like, if a club gets four or five COVID cases, will they get their game cancelled? Like, we know
that... I mean, it felt like Arsenal got involved. You know, that feels quite political, doesn't it? To have the opening game go down to COVID would have looked terrible for the Premier League,
I suspect. But, I mean, let's say ahead of the Man City game, Man City get four players who have COVID, who come down with COVID. Can they get their game cancelled? I don't think they can, because we had four and we weren't allowed. So, you know, what is the threshold then? What is the threshold where, like, there's a duty of care and responsibility and personal safety for not just the players, but everybody at the club? Because
last season they were cancelling games if there was one case, you know?
Exactly. Right, and it seems, it does seem from what Arteta has said that, like, a couple of the players were affected quite badly by their bout with COVID. Aubameyang was bedridden. Whether he's vaccinated or not vaccinated, I don't know. I mean, it's not for us to speculate on that side of things. You would hope that they are, because it you know, it doesn't stop you getting the virus, but it stops the worst effects of the virus.
It makes it more mild,
exactly. Yeah, you know. So we've had players who, you know, haven't been seen for a while. Maybe they're badly affected by COVID. And look, you don't want anybody to suffer from this virus. Or pass it on, or give it to somebody who might be a bit more vulnerable. So I don't know, really. I think we're scratching the surface of it, to be honest. And I think the Premier League is going to be afflicted by COVID for sure.
Well, I think we're just the first club to this season really, you know, suffer it. But there will surely be many more. You know, I've seen people saying, is this professional? You know, Arsenal players getting COVID? Or I don't really have concerns over that. I think that, as you say, England's very much unlocked. There aren't really restrictions. It's not as if people are breaking the law. You know?
Yeah. But and in that sense, I do have sympathy for the club. I have sympathy, you know, from the perspective that they cannot force anyone to get the vaccine if they don't want to get the vaccine.
No.
They can't. They can encourage them and they can advise them and they would say, this is preferable. We would like you to get the vaccine because if you get COVID, then you're not going to be as badly affected. But they can't literally force somebody to get it if they don't want to get it. So whether that informs other aspects of how a player's future or career is dealt with at the club, that's a different thing. But this is all going to play out, you know, in general terms. We might know that a player has got COVID, but we're not going to know whether or not that player is vaccinated. And that kind of information is private. You know, for me, I would urge everyone, if they could, to get the vaccine, because if you get this thing, you know, you don't know if you're going to be the exception. You know, young, fit men are are, you know, probably better at withstanding what the virus brings than other people in society, older people or more vulnerable people. But there are always exceptions, and you don't want anybody to be really, really sick or God, you know, for something really terrible to happen, or for them to suffer from, you know, some of the longer effects of COVID. Don't want that for anyone. So in that sense, I do have some sympathy for the club, because it's a really difficult situation to manage.
It is. I think the only thing, you know, in terms of it being a sort of a defining thing for the season, the only thing, silver lining, I mean, aren't many to come by, but I suppose if you've got it, you as an individual are probably have some protection at least for a number of months. You know, if you tear your hamstring, you don't get antibodies against future hamstring strains. If anything, you're probably more vulnerable. I guess once you've had the illness, assuming there are no long-term effects, you will have a degree of protection for a period of time, as far as I understand it. So there is that. You know, maybe it's not the worst thing that Arsenal are kind of experiencing their own little mini wave at the outset of the season. But it's going to be a very difficult situation for all clubs to manage this year.
Okay, it's my one, is it?
Yeah.
Okay, we've got a couple around the manager. Dazzy Pepper on the Discord says, 0 points from our first two games, already resignation among the fan base. And James, he says, we're unlikely to get anything against City. After the interlull, it will be Norwich at home, Burnley away, then Tottenham at home. What does Arteta need from those games to keep your confidence? He could plausibly get us to where we need to be this season. And also on the Discord, DJ Bowen says, can we assume that the earliest Arteta gets sacked is after the Spurs game? For me, if he doesn't have 7 points from the first six matches and is out of the League Cup, I've seen enough. I'd like to think I'm not being too harsh, but it's just what a big club would do.
I wonder why I'm separate from the fan base. The fan base and James. That weird man who goes to the games but is not a fan. I think, well, I can ask you a little mini question.
Sure.
How important do you think this game with West Brom is on Wednesday? Like, does Arteta need to win that?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he needs to win a game. We're two games in, we haven't scored, we haven't won anything. It's a game against a Championship side, albeit in the League Cup, and we need to win. And I'm not saying his future depends on the West Brom game or anything like that, but I think the sooner we correct our course, if you like, the better.
And do you think that will play into the selection?
I think it might, yeah. I think it might. I think,
I mean, he's not got loads of options as
no, exactly.
As he is.
Exactly. But I think it may well, yeah, I mean, I think he'll pick a relatively strong team for that one. Because, I mean, he doesn't have a great deal of rotation to do anyway. Might get Odegaard in the team, which would be good. Get some fitness into some of the guys who are struggling a bit for fitness right now.
Yeah,
maybe Ramsdale get a striker back in the team, get Aaron Ramsdale his debut. So it is important, but you know, this is the 64,000 million billion dollar question, right? Because a team that or a club that gives a manager so far £130 million to invest in new players, it feels like they would be prepared to give him time to work with those players.
Mm-hmm.
But if Arsenal get to the end of September and, you know, let's say things don't go as well against Norwich and Burnley as we would like, and then you get to a North London derby, it becomes really difficult, doesn't it?
Well, there's two sides to this. I mean,
well, there's one what we might do as fans, or what we think they should do as fans, but then what they will be thinking as a club.
Yes. What I meant more was that, yes, they have backed Arteta, and I have to be honest, I don't think there's any indication that they're preparing to get rid of him anytime soon. But the signings that they've made, as has been remarked upon by many people, are kind of future-proofed a little bit against managerial change. So as much as they've given Arteta a load of money, they have spent it on young players who you'd like to think could make a contribution to any coach's squad over the next 5 years.
Yeah.
So it's not like, it's not like Arteta said, I'm trying to think of an example. Like, when Unai Emery, there was all the talk about, was it Ever Banega? Were we going to get Ever Banega?
The
key, or Danny Parejo, somewhere like that.
Steven and Zonzi. Like,
yeah. It's not like they've gone and got a player that sort of feels specifically tied to this manager. It feels like they've bought players, I think, in a relatively sort of sensible profile who should be able to contribute regardless.
Mm.
So there's safety in that, but also not safety in that for Arteta. In terms of when he comes under pressure, I mean, if he loses 2 games this week, it will be very ugly, I think. I think he needs a result against West Brom just for, in terms of the mood and the atmosphere. Having not got anything at Brentford, I think people were sort of, I'm not going to say comfortable, but they were able to kind of reconcile the possibility that we might lose to Chelsea and Man City. But Brentford and West Brom are a different kettle of fish. If we come away from those three with nothing, it won't look good. Norwich goes without saying, he has to win. Burnley, I think.
You've got to win. This is Arsenal. You've got to win, with all due respect to Burnley, taking nothing away from them. We know they're difficult opponents. We know they're tough to play against. But you're at Arsenal Football Club, and you've spent £130 million in the summer. And I know the signings aren't all first-team signings. I know some of them are potential, etc., etc. But if we're in a place where we're sort of saying, well, maybe a draw away against Burnley would be all right, I think we're in a bad place.
Okay, I think we may be in that place. But, yeah.
Yeah.
I think Tottenham looms large, doesn't it?
Mm.
I mean, I don't realistically think Mikel Arteta will be sacked in September. I personally think that he will get almost, unless it is apocalyptically bad, I think he will certainly have until kind of November time. Mm. That's my impression. You know, it'll be like Unai Emery. You know, he got to November in a pretty bad run. And I think Arteta would be afforded at least that.
Yeah. If he can't get the team...
Do you tend to agree?
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think if he can't... If we're in November and, we're sitting in the bottom half of the table and there's no improvement in the way that we're playing, when we've got our players back... When nobody has COVID, when nobody's injured, when everything is Goldilocks, everything is just right, there are no more... Like, it just always feels like there's a reason... And I get some of them. I think some of them are valid. It always feels like there's a, well, as soon as this happens, or if this happens, or when this happens, we can judge properly. But I think 3 months into the season, if we're languishing in the bottom half of the table, that's enough time, even with all the other things that are going on, to make a judgment and an assessment that where we are is not where we should be, and that something has to change.
Yeah, I had a good debate, I think it was on Arsenal Vision podcast, about excuses. You know, as Arsenal fans, as football fans more generally, do we always kind of look for an excuse, an explanation for why we aren't successful, and does that disguise a sort of deeper problem? And my reaction to that is that I think both things can sort of be true. I think it is true that Arsenal are missing the absentees, but it is also true that they're not a complete panacea and will solve all the problems.
Mm.
Like, you know, there are other issues in this team and in this club. But I do think that Arteta will be given more patience from the owners than he will from the fans.
Yes.
I would say, with some certainty.
I think that's right. Let me just follow up one here from the Discord. We'll do some quick ones to finish off. Gezi Boy says, is it a coincidence that the 2 games with fans back are those in which we've seemed the most disorganized? You could see Mikel frantically trying to get instructions out during the game without being heard. Are we now a team without any creative freedom and without an ingrained structure? I thought that was quite an interesting one.
Yeah, because we talked about it a lot, didn't we? In the kind of period without fans, how attentive Arteta seemed and how detailed in his instructions and how that wasn't sustainable. And we talked about that situation on the left-hand side with Reece James overlapping and how no one was with him. And maybe in an empty stadium, it's easier to transmit a message that changes that. Well, this is the reality of football. And, you know, the version where Arteta was able to give quite detailed instructions to players and be heard, that was the distortion. This is what it's supposed to be like. So this is how it has to work. And this is the football we all want to see with a full Emirates Stadium. And the manager's absolutely drowned out. And actually, like, as bad as the season has been from an Arsenal perspective to date, I have absolutely loved, even just watching other games or clips from other games, it just feels like someone has breathed life into football again. So I'm grateful for that. But, you know, basically what I'm saying is if that is a problem for Arteta, it's a big problem because, you know, this is what he's going to face for the rest of his managerial career. Do you think it's affecting us?
It's hard to know yet because it's only been two games. But, you know, ultimately, you know, the job of the manager is to prepare his team all week on the training ground. And when they go out on the pitch, they have to have some measure of expression themselves. They have to know what way we're going to play, where we're supposed to be on the pitch. You know, those things are things that should be set in stone when you're preparing for a game.
Yeah.
After that, like a manager can't micromanage. You cannot micromanage. Was it Louis van Gaal or something who said, like, these managers who stand there shouting on the touchline, you know, they do it to make themselves, I'm paraphrasing here a bit, but they make themselves look good. You know, it makes them look energetic or involved or whatever it is. But ultimately, like, the guy who's 20 yards away from you can't hear you because of the crowd.
Yeah, the work is done.
The work should be done beforehand. And then, you know, if you need to get instructions on at some point, you can. Obviously, you know, when there's a little break in the game, you can call someone over and you can adjust certain things here and there. But really,
I think it's quite limited, though, how much you can actually affect the game without it being, okay, we're going to plan B, you know, that we've practiced and worked on and prepared. And actually, a lot of what you see from managers, I think, is them kind of living the adrenaline and the emotion. I mean, think of Unai Emery, you know, all that hand waving, it's for him. It's so that he feels connected to the game and connected to the fans. I don't think he realistically believes he's affecting what happens on the pitch with that, you know?
Do you think that's the case with Mikel Arteta, though? Because I feel like he is maybe a bit more of a control freak, maybe sounds a little harsh or whatever, but I do feel like he wants to, like he's playing football chess, he moves the pieces.
Yeah, I do. But then it's interesting because in press conferences, he always seems to say, well, we'll see another dimension to this team when we have fans back in the stadium. Mm. There seems a bit of a contradiction there. I mean, look, we've had one home game, right? It's difficult to know against maybe the best team in the league. Certainly one that's up there. It's difficult to know how the dynamics of a crowd will affect our performances.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel like a kind of marriage made in heaven, you know, between an Arteta team and a hungry crowd.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
That doesn't feel like a good fit right now. But we'll have to wait and see, I guess.
All right.
Until November.
Gone till November.
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, if things go really badly, you never say never in football.
That's true.
But that's just my instinct.
Have you got one or...?
I don't know. I do probably, but I they were sort of similar themes. When would you fire Arteta?
Yeah. Let's do some quick ones, because I've got a few here that I think are quite interesting. Then. So let's do some quick ones. Matthias, who's at Hugo_Gunnar, says, "Hi, guys. If Mikel Arteta isn't able to turn things around and ends up getting the old boot, do you think the recording of the documentary will have a negative impact on the recruitment process of a new manager? As in, will we have less candidates interested in the job because of the prospect of having a camera shoved in your face following you around all day, because that's not very pleasant?"
Yeah, I mean, Spurs obviously appointed Mourinho, didn't they? I think. They didn't. They appointed him prior to the documentary. I think he was maybe fired during the filming of it. But there was some sense that anyway, that, you know, they wanted to project this image of them as like a global super club, and it was felt that a big name manager was part of that. I think that it would be an inconvenience to any incoming manager, but probably not sufficient to put them off. And I suspect if they were coming into the club, they might be able to be like, right, well, this is what I'm prepared to do and this is what I'm not prepared to do. You've got to hope so, right? I mean, it would be a disaster if it felt like it was genuinely affecting things at that level.
Yeah. I don't think that would be a deal breaker for any manager, because they're used to having cameras and stuff like that. But, you know,
there's a groundswell of some, like, the name Antonio Conte is being bandied around a lot, isn't it, on social media?
Yeah.
Do you think that's, like, plausible? Like, do you think he'd want to come and manage Arsenal?
I don't know. I mean, he's a very high-profile manager with a lot of success under his belt, and you can see why people would be interested in him if Arteta were to get the boot. If things don't improve, you could easily see why they would be, or he would be, top of people's list. But whether he would want to come or not, I don't know. I guess it depends where we are and what he thinks he could achieve. He wasn't slow to get out of Inter, was he, when things weren't going great there? So
Interesting. I mean, yeah, this documentary is going to be interesting viewing, I think, whatever happens.
Dean Van Wyn says, "How confident are you that Arsenal can regain the league title by 2034 when they'd match Liverpool's 30-year drought? It seems crazy, but that's only 12 seasons after this one, and the path back to the top for Arsenal doesn't seem easy or obvious. So on a scale of 1 to 100, how confident are you that Arsenal could win the league title by 2034?
Low for me. I think I see a lot of comparisons between Liverpool's kind of 90s funk and where we are now. And I think it could be as difficult a climb back up. I think, if anything, the circumstances are more difficult than what they face because of the expansion of wealth of other clubs and how competitive the landscape is now. So I would say, how confident am I we will win the league title by 2034? Probably about like 25%, maybe. You know, it could happen. But I think it probably feels more likely to not.
I would say about 7%.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. Maybe
things
it'll all click
very quickly.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. But maybe it'll all click at some point, and maybe we'll get the right manager, and things will come together, and we will be competitive and what have you. But right now, it's very difficult to see that as a possibility. Here's one from Serge Designs, who's at Serge Designs, who says, "What are your thoughts on Willian liking Chelsea's Instagram posts? Just a silly action by a careless player, or a microcosm of the mess we're in?" And if people don't know what this is, Chelsea posted on their Instagram 2-0 win over Arsenal, and it was, the caption was something like, "Can you imagine not being Chelsea?" or something like that. And Willian liked it.
Yeah. I think he's done at Arsenal, Willian, isn't he? And we all know it. I think it's optically, it's really bad. I think with social media and footballers, you've always got to be a bit careful because it's not entirely clear who's running it all the time. So you can kind of give a bit of benefit of the doubt there. Also, sometimes they don't see it the same way as us with kind of rivalries and allegiances. But yeah, I think it's just the latest in a kind of litany of moments that make you reflect on what a disastrous deal that's turned out to be.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think Willian's Arsenal coffin does not need a final nail. But if it did, that would have been it,
I think. Yeah. I think I know your answer on this, but Tom F. on Twitter says, when did we become so obsessed with whether a centre-back is left or right-sided? We used to just play the best defenders. Now Murray's left-footedness seems to trump whether he's actually the best man for the job. I mean, do you think there's a case to drop him based on yesterday?
Yeah.
You know, irrespective of the fact he's our left-footed guy.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes, yes. I think I so. You know, I think... I don't think Rob Holding was brilliant.
He was okay, though.
He was okay.
Should have scored, probably.
Yeah, he should have. Should have. But look, I think we're suffering from a paucity of central defenders. I mean, I know there's a... This will spark a whole other debate, and we just don't have time for it. But, like, what the level of Pablo Marie's performances say about William Saliba, and I don't mean this to be negative, like, you can't tell me that William Saliba... I'm not saying he would have, like, dominated Lukaku or anything like that. I think he, as a young defender, would have found him tough to deal with. But there's nothing that you're seeing from Pablo Marie that makes you think sending William Saliba on loan is really a good idea.
No. I understand he had a good performance for Marseille at the weekend as well.
What a crazy game that was. Did you see all the fucking shit?
I saw bits and pieces, yeah. Seemed absolutely mad.
Crazy stuff.
I think Marseille on the pitch will be entertaining enough, to be honest, this season with the formation they're playing and the style of football. But yeah, you can't help but reflect on that and think, crikey, what must they think of William Saliba?
Yeah. Right, look, we got to leave it there because we've been going too long and we've all got to go about our days and, you know, get on with things and get ready for this big game against West Brom on Wednesday. So, look, we'll see what happens there. As ever, thank you guys for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks for sharing in the dark times, I guess. And hopefully sunshine is around the corner.
Maybe some catharsis too. Yeah. Exactly.
What do you reckon? 4-0 win over City on Saturday or Sunday? Is it Sunday?
Saturday morning, I think. Saturday lunchtime.
Oh, God.
Yeah, they're the worst, I think.
Oh, my God.
And, yeah, I think it's the first time we'll have played in this round of the League Cup for about 25 years. So, yeah, let's see how we get on.
Right.
It's very difficult to have a good feeling about it, even that game.
Yeah.
You know?
It is. It is. Until
we're coming in with no form, no momentum.
Exactly. Until good things start happening, it's hard to think about good things. Mm. You know? It is very easy to wallow at this moment in time. But concerns that people have and worries that people have and all of the rest are being borne out by what we're doing on the pitch. Simple as that. There's not much there that gives you cause for optimism. Even if you are very firmly in the when we get players back, we'll be better camp, until we get those players back, we still have football to play. So let's see what we can do in this coming week. Hopefully, you know, it can be a little bit better. I did like that Mikel Arteta quote. Hopefully things will get better, he said, after the match.
Well, we can all agree with that.
Okay, look, let's leave it there. As ever, thank you very much indeed for listening, and we will catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.